This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 70. Welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network. I am your host, Riley Bowman.
Riley, the man who almost has more camera lenses than he does guns. And I am Jacob Paulson.
Jacob's the guy who just bought his first survival rifle. So, congrats.
Thank you. What's the next purchase? Like another camera lens or another gun? Like, are you making a conscious effort to ensure that you always have more guns than camera lenses, or is it more of a coincidence?
It's more of what a person needs. You get into photography and there's different lenses for different purposes, just like there's different guns for different purposes.
Right.
But I would definitely say, you kind of get to a point where you get about four or five lenses you figure out that's about what you need for most things. Guns, you can never have too many guns.
Right, naturally.
In fact, the survival rifle is not the only gun you came away with yesterday, right?
That's true. So yesterday, got the Henry survival rifle, which I'm really excited about. I totally feel like James Bond, like taking that thing all apart and sticking it in the stock. And my kids thought that was just the coolest thing ever. All other guns are now inferior compared to the Henry survival rifle, as far as my 9-year-old is concerned. And yesterday I also got the FNS, 4-inch barrel, 9mm, nice gun.
Cool. It's a good day for you. It's a good day for, for anybody, anytime they get a new gun.
Yeah.
Very good. So today, folks, interesting topic on hand, and we are calling this Muscle Memory Mistakes, 8 Inadvertent Training Blunders. We're looking forward to getting into that. But first, this day in history, as it is our typical feature. And this day in history, I got to admit, Jacob, it is a little bit, there's those days where like we could put like 5 or 6 things in here in this category, right? Really interesting days in history. And this one just didn't have a whole lot that stood out to me. But this one did a little bit. This is 1961. So today being November 16th, President John F. Kennedy decided on this date in 1961 to increase military aid to South Vietnam, to Saigon. And this was without committing U.S. combat troops. And why I thought this was interesting was that, we really didn't get fully involved into Vietnam for another couple of years. And, a lot of people may not fully remember or understand that this whole conflict, the whole Vietnam conflict, was really going on for some time prior to the U.S. involvement, prior to us sending, actual troops over there. And in fact, started with President Kennedy committing some aid. He was sending, resources to South Vietnam to assist them as the Viet Cong continued to, which was the communists, of course, as they continued to push their way across and throughout Vietnam. The idea, it's interesting because the idea was, like many conflicts that we've been involved with, it's like, okay, let's send some aid. And then you just eventually find yourself getting sucked in. So anyway, this all started once again, much earlier than you might have remembered or thought. 1961, President Kennedy deciding to get involved and send military aid over to South Vietnam. So there you go.
There you go.
There you go. So today's episode, by the way, is brought to you by Guardian Nation Live, which is, we've talked about Guardian Nation. Guardian Nation Live is a part of Guardian Nation, a huge part and a huge opportunity. Really what this is a monthly webinar for you to see face-to-face and interact with top industry professionals. And tomorrow we've got a really exciting one coming up. We'll feature and tease that a little bit more later on in the episode today. So I hope that you'll look forward to that. And otherwise, Jacob, why don't we get into the topic? MMMs. This is our new coined phrase. MMMs. And what the MMMs. Heck is MMM?
It's not a delicious chocolate treat that melts in your mouth and not in your hand, I can tell you that.
Well, that'd be it. Yeah, I mean, that's M and M But we say really fast on M&Ms. This is very similar though, huh? Very similar sounding. M&Ms. Yes, what is the triple M? What is that?
Muscle memory mistake.
Yeah. So the whole concept of today's episode is, what are some of the mistakes that we might be making as it relates to muscle memory? And maybe let's just spend a brief moment and talk about what muscle memory is, Jacob. I know this is something that's is huge for you. I mean, you spend a good deal of time, I know, thinking and talking about this, as do I. What is muscle memory, and why do we talk about it so often?
So, you know, it comes down to habits and routines and the way the brain is wired. A habit is basically, by definition, something that is an automated or automatic response to a cue in an environment. So you have some sort of cue in your environment, and that cue triggers in your brain that you need to make some sort of automatic response. And that automatic response is, by definition, automatic. It is whatever is most instinctive, natural, and automated for you to do. So for example, when you trip, you automatically bring your hands forward to catch your fall. Like, that's automated. The body just does that, right? It's just the way you're wired. A lot of us, we have a lot of new automated muscle memory responses based on having cell phones now. Like, you might have an automated response to pat your pocket before you walk out the door to make sure you're not forgetting your phone, things like that. So automated response. I'll give you another example. You know, Riley and I, we've grown up in winter environments. As a driver, when you're young, when you're a new driver, and you hit a patch of ice or slippery road, the automated muscle response is to hit the brakes, which is, as it were, a negative. You know, it's good that we have automated response to throw our hands forward when we trip so that we don't smack our faces into the ground. But when you're driving and you hit a patch of ice and your automated response is to slam on the brakes of the car, that's actually an MMM. That's a muscle memory mistake. Your automated system, your automated response to the cue in the environment is actually bad. Right. It's not good. And it takes a lot of work to train the body to not do that, because it is instinctive. It is natural. But with work, you can teach yourself to not slam on the brakes, or car manufacturers just build brakes that essentially prevent people from causing problems when they have an MMM. So relative to guns, you know, muscle memory is this idea that I'm training my body to do something. Either it's already instinctively natural and I'm just, you know, perfecting that, or I have to teach my body to do something based on a cue in my environment that doesn't come natural. The other place, and I know I'm maybe beating this harder than we need to beat it, but sports and athletics is the other perfect example of muscle memory. Like, this is what we train athletes to do. In fact, if you know anything about Tony Dungy, for you football fans, this was his like flag that he took in when he would take job interviews for head coach. He would talk about how his intention as a coach was to train athletes based on muscle memory cues in their environment. And he'd say, "Hey, I want to just drill habitual automated responses. I want my athletes to not have to think ever." And that was the idea. So, and as you know, that turned out pretty well for him. And it also turned out pretty well for me and Riley, since we got Peyton Manning out of the deal later on. But anyway, so that's the idea. Is it's about automated response based on a cue in an environment. Call it a habit, call it muscle memory, or call it instinct or automated response. It's all the same thing.
Yeah. And we like to throw around the term muscle memory. And I wanted to just point out that, you know, there really is no such thing as far as muscles having memory. It's a nervous system thing, right, Jacob?
Nervous system and brain. Yeah, it's right. It's about that subconscious part of the brain that no scientist understands really well, except that they know it's there, and it runs automated responses.
Right, right, exactly. So, I mean, the point being, I mean, yeah, we can actually develop muscles and strengthen them in ways in that it makes it easier for them to continue to be used in that way, which also is a part of, I think, of kind of muscle memory. I mean, like you do the same thing over and over and over repeatedly, then the muscles that are being used doing that get a little bit stronger and a little bit more toned. And so then they're also going to, but they're just going to make it easier to receive that stimulus, that signal that comes down from the brain through the nerves and then to that muscle. Like, they're just going to become faster and better at responding to that signal. But the muscles themselves don't actually have memory. But when we do use the term muscle memory, we're talking about this automatic response, this habit, this trained response. Okay. Now, I think before we go any further, I want to throw out just one thing. And I think this ties into where we're going to go. And that one thing is that there are certain areas, certain things that we do, particularly as it relates to self-defense and shooting, that is important, in fact, necessary for us to develop this so-called muscle memory. There are probably other areas relating to that I think we don't necessarily want to entirely rely on muscle memory, meaning that let me use an example. You have a stimulus, okay? Let's say the stimulus is, guy approaches you and begins quickly drawing from his pocket, and you catch the glint of a knife or some other weapon and you're carrying, and you've got, you have an immediate stimulus that requires immediate action, potentially, if you're going to come out of this situation alive in one piece. And so, the automatic response should be that your hand goes immediately to your clothing, your shirt, rips it out of the way. Other hand goes, your shooting hand goes to the gun, and all without thinking, you draw and that gun comes out and you're right on target and you're ready to deal with this threat. That is certain, so my point is, drawing from like a holster is something that should be automatic, in that we don't have to think about the actual act of doing it, of actually drawing from the holster. So we've learned it. And hopefully we've learned it correctly, right? So that we're drawing properly, so we don't flag ourselves or point the gun at somebody else necessarily, things of that nature. But we get to a point where we've practiced it enough times that it has become automatic. And that's a necessary muscle memory skill, in my opinion. But
yeah,
I was just going to add to that. When I was saying that there may be some things where we don't necessarily want to be so much automatic, would be things where we actually need to use our brain to think through a situation, make decisions. But that's the thing. There are times where we need to be able to make decisions and think through things. But realize, anytime you have to actually think about something, it does take time. And so where it makes sense, we want muscle memory, because the automatic response is always faster than you having to think through something, decide what to do, and then proceed to do it.
And not only is it faster, this is what I was going to add, and this is probably a subject for its entirely own podcast episode, but it's necessary because it's all you're going to be capable of doing. When the heart rate goes to a certain level because of fear and adrenaline, you lose the ability to do anything that requires fine motor skills. You only can do things that require gross motor skills. It's that condition red that we talk about. And so when you're in that condition red, you need the muscle memory, because otherwise you're really not capable of doing anything.
Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily say that it's impossible for you to use fine motor skills.
Sure.
But they become a lot more difficult. And certainly the more of a habit that you've developed in doing something, it's going to be easier for you to cope with the loss of dexterity and fine motor skills. And that's actually, I think that's one of the best ways I've ever stated that, in that there's not a whole lot we can do. Like, we can't actually prevent our bodies from reacting the way they do and losing fine motor skills, but we can develop things and ways and habits that help us cope with that loss of fine motor skills.
Yeah, let me give an example. This is an interesting one. So this was a research study that was done with a group of I can't remember if they were Green Berets or Navy SEALs or some special force division. And they essentially created two different test groups, and they did a bunch of training on how to subdue someone physically and submit them to custody. And with one of the groups, they included in the training how to put on the flex cuffs and to, put on the restraint. And with the other group, they did not, because they knew that this is, putting on those restraints is a very fine motor skill. And so the difference between the group who had trained that and the group who did not was 800%. So the group who had trained it was 800% more able to do that in the moment than the group who had not. Because when you've been wrestling with somebody on the ground and you're in a physical altercation, and then you're trying to do something very fine motor skill-ish, like put on the cuffs, the group that had not trained it, like they couldn't get it done. Like they had a hard time putting on the restraint. Something that, the altercation's already over, but because this requires, fine motor skill and my body's already all hyped up, it was just, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So here's another thing. Before we're going to talk about and highlight some mistakes, and that's kind of what I'm about to say next. And that is, there's certainly times where we can intentionally, attempt to develop muscle memory or develop habits. Much the same way that Michael Jordan, would spend, part of his training each day shooting, 500 jump shots or whatever, like he's very much intentionally every day working on that skill repeatedly, trying to make sure that muscle memory, that habit and whatever is all, and it becomes very automatic too, right? There's times where, when the ball is passed to Michael, without thinking, when he looks at the situation around him and goes, oh, this is the time to shoot. Like once he makes that decision to actually shoot, after that, it's all automatic, right? Because it's such a developed habit. But that's something that was very much deliberately learned and he spent time doing. So obviously, we spent a lot of time talking about things to do, drills, practice, whatever. We spent a lot of time, hyping up on dry practice, using the CERT pistol to help facilitate that. That is a very much intentional working towards developing muscle memory. I think what we're going to kind of get into next though, Jacob, is things and areas where we tend to develop bad habits or muscle memory mistakes, which is where we've termed this MMM term. I think there's a lot of these, I think, are developed without us even realizing it. And that's an important thing to understand. See, basically, the concept with developing a habit or muscle memory is just repeatedly doing something, the same thing over and over and over again. Whether you do it consciously or subconsciously, eventually it's going to become an automatic thing that you do, an automatic response.
Right. These are not things that you're just born hardwired to do them wrong. Like that'd be a separate list of things. These are things that you have inadvertently, accidentally taught yourself to do that are bad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, that's where we're headed right now is we've got, and this is certainly not all of them. This was just, eight things that we came up with real quick and we felt like we had time to discuss. So eight inadvertent training blunders that lead to making muscle memory mistakes. And along with that, just before we actually jump into the first one here, we talk about, these being training blunders. That's exactly what they are. They start out that way, whether you realize it or not. And I've been on record as saying, you should train like you fight, right? You should always train and do things in the same way. And I'll probably repeat this today, but you should train like you need to fight. That the whole premise of that statement comes right back to avoiding making these MMMs. So let's get into the first one. This was, Jacob, you worded it like this, not controlling the expenditure of ammunition. Why don't you explain?
Yeah. So in my observation at a gun range, when I watch defensive shooters practice and do repetitions, generally what happens is, we load up all of our magazines, we put, we load them all up, we get all ready, we set all the mags out or we put them in our mag pouches. And then we when we're ready to shoot, we draw the gun and we start firing. And the thing that, very quickly differentiates some of the like really well-trained self-defense shooters from everyone else is that the majority of people are inclined to keep on pressing that trigger until the gun is empty. They will empty the magazine and then shove in the next one and then keep shooting. And they'll do that as many times as they have magazines, or they'll just, stop at some point when they want to reflect. But the best shooters are the ones who will fire a series of shots. Maybe it's one, maybe it's two, maybe it's three, maybe it's four. And then they'll pause. Even though they still have more ammunition in the gun, they will pause. And they will essentially train themselves. They'll create the muscle memory to reevaluate the situation. And this is really important because the training blunder here, the MMM, is the tendency to empty the gun without need. In a self-defense situation, you don't want to be somewhere where you have nine shots in the gun and you fire three and the threat has been stopped and you would, you know, because of the MMM, the muscle memory mistake, you shoot six more. It's bad. It's bad ethically, it's bad legally, and it's bad tactically because you might need those extra six shots for a second threat or for something else. And so there's just a variety of reasons why this is a big MMM for me.
I think this one's really interesting, and I'm actually glad we're starting right off the bat with this because there's a part of me that disagrees with you. So how about a little healthy debate here, and without going too crazy into it because of time, and we've got seven more things to cover. But I look at a deadly force encounter much like this. Am I going to have, you know, if I got an active threat in my face, particularly if they have a weapon, a gun, am I going to, you know, when we got an active threat, am I going to fire, you know, however many shots, three, four, five, six shots, and then pause and go, is he down? Is he done? I mean, ideally, I mean, that's what you are going to do. You're going to shoot until you see a threat. You know, stop. Okay. Stop. When the threat ceases to be a threat, then I'm going to stop. But I'm also training myself to shoot accurate shots as rapidly as I possibly can. And realizing that happens in a very short time frame, that I could very easily see myself throwing 10, 12 rounds at somebody before even having the opportunity to evaluate whether they continue to be a threat to me. So are you saying I'm being unethical in that?
No, not necessarily. I think that it's unethical to fire past the point when we already know the threat is no longer a threat. I think that, you know, this goes back to, what episode was that, Riley? Is it episode 4, where we talked about shooting to kill versus shooting to wound, shooting to stop, shooting to warn? It comes down to this idea that you ethically have an obligation to stop shooting when the threat has been eliminated. Now, to each, we don't know, you know, on a case-by-case basis, how many shots that's going to take. And in fact, we might not know if the threat actually has been eliminated. We might need to keep shooting in order to feel confident based on our own perception, beliefs, or knowledge, or even experience to feel like the threat has been stopped. So if you feel like you need to empty the gun to stop the threat, I'm saying that's fine. But, you know, I'm also suggesting that it's probably a good idea to build in cognition. So take pauses, reevaluate, and determine if you need to keep shooting or not. And if you teach yourself to do that, even though it may be a piece of paper, a target at a gun range, if you pause and reevaluate, you build the correct muscle memory, which is this idea of cognition. Force my brain to think, is the threat still a threat? And if the answer is yes, keep shooting. If the answer is no, stop shooting.
So I'm going to, and so by the way, I agree with you in that, you know, and I do think that we're approaching this from two different directions. We both agree that we should stop shooting when a threat is no longer a threat. To give an example of where this comes into play quite often with some of like our justified stories we share in the Monday episodes of the podcast, I'm thinking of a video, and actually it's in our podcast promo video that we are, you know, we got a little promo video. We're trying to, you know, get more listeners, of course, always. And in there is a guy that, you know, that you see these thugs come into his house to rob him, right? And he shoots at them, and he ends up chasing them out the house and then continues shooting them as they're running away from the house, and then kind of goes across the lawn and continues shooting at the getaway car as they're driving away. Do you know the scene I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, yep.
Right, I'm with you. Right, and so underwear. So I, yeah, exactly. Which is great. It's actually a great video. But the I see this as being kind of a correlation to that. That I think there's some similar threads here because, you know, he's thinking, you know, crap, I got to keep firing. You know, and you know, I would think that when a threat begins to turn away and they start going the other way, well, at that point, that threat is done being a threat, and we should stop shooting. And so, I mean, I do see what you're getting at, Jacob. And I think one, maybe almost a better way, I think, of describing what the right way to train would be to avoid making muscle memory mistakes would be to randomize the shots that you take. Too often people, and I call this the double, this to me, this is an MMM, and it's the classic double tap. People, I will see people specifically train, double tap, bop, 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 you know, bop, bop. And it's like, why are you doing that? You know, because guess what? That's going to be, you do that over and over and over and over and over again. You're in a deadly force encounter. What are you going to do? You're going to go, bop, bop, and you're going to wait, and you're like, oh gosh, yeah, they're still shooting at me, bop, bop. Oh, they're still shooting at me. Bop, bop. You know, like, no, like you come out of the holster and you just bop, 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 bop until you see the threat cease to be a threat. It is the ideal, in my opinion. And so I think introducing random variables into your practice, I think, is helpful. By the way, the LASR software that we love so much in conjunction with the CERT pistol can be set up to where you've got targets and you can designate targets to be required to be hit a certain number of times before they, in theory, go down. And you can actually set that variable so that, you know, it'll go down anywhere between one and, you know, five shots, let's just say. Okay. And so what you're doing is you're shooting at the one target and at, you know, maybe you shoot it three times and it gives a signal that it's down. And then you move on to the next target and maybe that one requires four and then it's down. And then you go to the next one and bang, you shoot it once and it indicates that it's down. I really like that aspect of the LASR software.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it in that detail, but I do reuse LASR that way, and it's really great that you always set a range. You can do the same thing with the reload setting on LASR. You set a range. I want to have a reload called every blank to blank number of shots fired. So yeah, great example, way to say that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's move on to MMM number two, and that is picking a gun up off the table. And where does this come from, Jacob?
Yep. See this all the time. So, you know, think about this. When you're at a gun range, some gun range, it's because they have a rule maybe that you're not allowed to draw from a holster or have a certain kind of holster and you didn't come prepared with the right kind of holster that they actually would allow. And so what inevitably you do is you set everything down on that little table in your firing line, right? You have a little table or counter space and you put your guns there and your magazines there and your ammo there and everything's kind of set up there. And when you're ready to fire, where's that going to come from? It's going to come from the tables. You're going to reach down, pick it up, present it on target, and do your firing sequence. Well, that's a problem because the MMM here is that your muscle memory you're building is to pick a gun up off of a table in front of you. So in a life-threatening situation, have you built an MMM, right? Have you built a muscle memory mistake that's going to have you reaching out in front of you into the air where there's nothing, like trying to grab your gun when in fact it's in the holster on your hip or on your ankle?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. And you're right, because so often, particularly if it's an indoor range, which many people do frequent indoor ranges, that's kind of the standard operating procedure, because most of the time you're discouraged from drawing out of a holster. So the only way you can really do things is to load up your gun, set it on the table, and then pick it up and shoot it. And when you're done, you put it back down. And, you know, that's... I would even almost go so far as to say that the more dangerous part of that aspect is building in the muscle memory that when you're done shooting, that you immediately put the gun down, which is actually closely related to another one of our MMMs that we're going to get to here momentarily. This is a real thing, okay? And before we get any further, I think we should address a very important idea here, Jacob, because I suspect that it's possible we have a listener that's like, well, how big of an issue is this really? And let me tell you, it is a big deal. We've got documented instances, and we'll talk about a couple of them here today, real life instances, and a lot of them are law enforcement, but a lot of law enforcement, you know, stories are, they're the ones that happen to be the best documented, and law enforcement encounters, you know, more of these types of situations than your average citizen does as well. So, I mean, and just because it's a law enforcement story doesn't mean it doesn't have application to a civilian world. So anyway, do these muscle memory mistakes actually translate to the real world? Do they actually impact somebody that is in a deadly force encounter in a negative way? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And I'm trying to refrain from, I'm trying to think, is there any stories that we can share right now, Jacob, I think that would help really drive this point home without giving away some of the other MMMs?
Yeah, here's one that comes to mind. This is an MMM that's not on our list, but maybe it gives some correlation that will help. So there was a law enforcement department, I think in California, but I'd have be careful on my source there. I'm not sure if it was California. And this law enforcement agency, they were doing some force-on-force encounter, related training drills. And because they didn't want to use their real guns and because the agency was too cheap to spring for some training guns, they actually had the officers pointing their fingers, like making a gun shape with their hand. Okay. So the good guy would make the gun shape with the hand. And then the good guy would run the drill, would do whatever it was that they were doing to respond. And they did this for some time until they had some reports from the field that officers on the street were pointing their fingers at BGs, at bad guys and bad gals, in responses. Now, it's actually kind of funny because the way that it all kind of went down is that they actually didn't have any huge incidents because of this. No one died, but they quickly changed the training regimen. They're like, oh, whoa, like we can no longer do that. Like we had officers pointing fingers at people, like instead of when they should be drawing their guns. And so think about that kind of muscle memory. It's like going for a holster, breaking retention, proper draw stroke, presenting on target, something that does get trained. But instead, these guys, they just present their finger because one specific drill they had been running was building that MMM.
Yeah, that... That seems like a crazy example, right? It's like, really? Like, would this really happen? Yeah, it really would and does and has happened. And we've got some other examples and stories that will come up later in the episode illustrating how poor training and developing these MMMs results in mistakes made in the field. And that is exactly our point. We want to try to avoid that and hopefully bring to attention to our listeners, start paying attention to how you train and look for opportunities to discover things that you might be doing that, while it makes sense to do it at the range or in your home or something, like as much as possible, you want to eliminate that if it works against you in a real life deadly force encounter. So let's get to number three. And this is a big one for me because I see this mistake made all the time. And it frankly bothers me. And so every time, and we just ran into this at the range day, Jacob, with our special range day winner that we did, like a month ago now, maybe a little more than a month. And there was a point where we were doing some exercises, and I was asking the participants, it was our winner and his fiance that were there, and I said, draw your gun out of the holster. And they would just kind of come out of the holster very casually because the focus wasn't on the draw. It was on, whatever the other skill was that we were working on at the time. And I'd be like, no, when you draw out of the holster, I want you to draw the holster with meaning, with purpose. Draw like you mean it is a phrase you'll hear me say often when we're working on a range with various drills. Because the danger here is that when we do get focused on something else, so like we're going to work on a reload drill, we're going to work on, name the drill, anything else. If it's not specifically related to the actual act of drawing the gun, then when we are prepping to get ready to do the drill, we tend to, just come out of the holster very casually. So I'll say, draw from the holster, and they'll just kind of, come up and, just very lackadaisically. And this is real common. Two, okay. This is actually a really good example. Anytime that you have somebody that they got their gun and it's in a holster and it's unloaded, and then you say, okay, we're going to go ahead and proceed and do whatever. They know they got to load their gun. And then you might even tell them, okay, go ahead and load and make your gun ready. Well, anytime you start out with an unloaded gun in the holster and you go, yeah, I got to load it, you'll come out. I guarantee this about just about anybody, unless they've been in one of my classes, they will come out of the holster very slowly, very casually, come right in front of their face and grab their magazine, insert it into the gun, rack the gun, and then they'll proceed to point into the target and, do the drill. what you will hear out of my mouth is draw like you mean it. Draw like it counts. Because every time you come out of that holster is an opportunity to reinforce the muscle memory. And it is one that should be automatic. Drawing from that holster should be automatic every time. So every opportunity you have to draw, you should draw like you mean it. And that means come out with it full speed and fully extend to the target. And then, if necessary, come back to your chest, do your load, and then proceed with whatever it is you're working on.
Yeah. And a point of clarification, in case anyone's misunderstanding this, I think it's really important. Riley does not just mean speed. Like, speed is not the factor here. It's a proper draw stroke. It's about this idea of, because I'm not drawing to fire right now, I'm just going to kind of, draw it incorrectly or poorly. It's about, like, I mean, not to say speed isn't a factor, but when you say draw like you mean it, you're not just referring to move quickly, are you?
Well, I do mean move quickly, provided that you have mastered the actual draw, okay? Once you gotten to the point where you know how to draw, you know how to do it correctly every time, then I expect that you actually draw full speed, like you mean it every time. If you're a newer shooter, and particularly if you're working on the actual skill of drawing, then I would expect that you do things at a reasonable pace. But I actually will go on record that once you've mastered the draw stroke, then I expect this of our officers in our department. I expect, and they would get chastised if they don't do this, every time the gun comes out of the holster, it comes out full speed and then straight out to the target. And then they can come back and prep their gun or do whatever it is they got to do. But I mean, I appreciate the clarification, because it's certainly, if you're not to that point yet, if you haven't mastered that, I don't want you going full speed, but I do want you to practice it correctly. Not to suggest that there aren't times where you shouldn't come back and revisit the skill of drawing from a holster. And in those cases, even though you may have technically already mastered it, you're just refreshing and making sure that you have everything down to a T. Well, yeah, you're deliberately spending some time focusing on the steps, getting it, right and perfect, because we do need to do that from time to time, so that, because it is all about practice and repetition, but it only matters if you're doing it correctly as well every time.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah. So, watch out for that one, because I see it all the time. Now let's get on to targets. This is on the list. I'm trying to remember exactly what we meant by this.
I think there's a lot of things here. Yeah. No. I think there's a lot of issues. I think it originally was spawned by an incident that I'm familiar with, where some research was done that essentially suggested that because law enforcement was training with silhouette targets, it lessened their ability to be able to cognitively identify if a target in the field on the street was or was not a threat. And so that's kind of what originally sparked this. But I think when we talk about an MMM, a muscle memory mistake, it's more than just what kind of target am I using.
That's right. I do remember that. And we had a little bit of conversation in our show prep on this as well. And I believe I shared with you the story going through post-instructor school to become a patrol rifle instructor myself. They did an exercise during low light shooting. So it was done at night. And let me just set this up real fast, and I'll try to make this as brief as possible. But we had basically a ton of targets. And at this range we were at, it's a phenomenal range. Targets are, they're able to turn them. Okay. So they're sideways, so you don't shoot them then. They can turn them so they face you. There's targets that can move back and forth laterally. And they had this all set up so that we were in the dark with blue and red lights flashing, because this was a law enforcement course. So that we're able to see things. And the whole idea was that when you see what you believe is a threat, then, proceed to shoot. And of course, we'd use our tactical lights, weapons mounted or otherwise. We would see what we thought was a threat, light it up, fire our rounds, and then the target would turn back sideways, or it would continue moving past or whatever, right? That's the situation. And what was really eye-opening was that when we got done, they turned on all the regular bright lights, so we could see everything clearly. And what nobody realized prior to that exercise beginning was that there were about half to two-thirds of the targets were actually no-shoot targets. They were actually, targets that were printed images of people, but they had no weapon in their hand. They were not doing anything that was threatening. They were simply, an image, a silhouette of a person. then there were targets that were a picture of somebody and he had a gun in the hand, a knife in the hand, making some sort of threatening movement or whatever, okay? But the point was is that nobody, I mean, like, nobody saw that the, you know, because this had kind of been ingrained in our minds that, hey, we're going to shoot some targets. And as soon as things started flipping around, it was like, oh, bang, 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 bang. And you get done, you realize I wasn't actually looking at or paying attention to what those targets were, what they were doing. And that was eye-opening to me, and I think is a perfect correlation to what you just mentioned, Jacob. So
yeah, I think you nailed it. That's the point. Is it's like, are we putting ourselves? Are we creating an MMM, right? Where we're not going to have cognition, right? That we're just going to start firing at, you know, whatever it is because it's popping up in front of us,
right? And that really ties back to one of the first things I said, which was there are some things that absolutely make sense and is necessary to be automatic and, you know, completely ingrained in muscle memory, and that, like drawing from a holster, performing a reload. But some areas too where we don't necessarily want that. We don't want to necessarily have an automatic response every time we see a silhouette to just go ahead and shoot it. We need to actually use some brain, you know, power and evaluate the situation better. On to number five, MMM, you know, mistake number five, we have listed here as simply scanning. And Jacob, I think you described this as we were talking through this. You were talking about how, you know, a lot of times we might be at a shooting range and we're isolated into these shooting lanes. And that the danger would be that we tend to get so focused on, you know, we are only addressing a target immediately in front of us. So everything we do is focused in that direction. Right. And so we might be kind of subconsciously training ourselves to only be concerned with what is immediately in front of us.
Right. And unfortunately, tunnel vision is already a problem, right? Like tunnel vision is already a physiological symptom of that kind of response. So when you're in that kind of environment where you think your life is being threatened, you're going to go into tunnel vision anyway. So that's an expected thing. That's a documented, very well researched, expected physical, you know, reaction. But the MMM is that because we're in that gun range and because we're kind of isolated in this lane and we only have stationary targets right in front of us, we don't train the proper technique to break tunnel vision. So good law enforcement agencies and military departments, they teach their shooters that as soon as you get done shooting, as soon as you stop that threat, you need to break the tunnel vision. And breaking the tunnel vision means moving the head physically, like purposefully moving the head and moving the eyes and scanning your environment. Because the research would suggest that when you do that, when you force your head to pivot on its neck, and when you force the eyes to look at other things, you essentially take with what that physiological reaction of tunnel vision, and you reduce it immediately by that response of movement. And unfortunately, the MMM is that in the gun range, when we're shooting, indoor or outdoor, I think there's a tendency to not scan the environment and break tunnel vision because we're in an environment where we have one lane, it's that target right in front of us, and so of course we're focused on looking forward.
Yeah, very good points, and so true. You know, We will do exercises where, you know, maybe we have a shooter on a line and we'll have a buddy, a partner, you know, stand behind them. And so that the idea is that we want them to, you know, work through a certain drill, you know, shoot a target or whatever it is. And then upon completing neutralizing that threat, then they're expected to do scan. And immediately, you know, this is how I scan. You know, I'm focused on the threat. I shoot the threat. The threat's no longer a threat. Then I'm going to kind of real quickly scan, you know, to the left and to the right, but only about a 45 degree angle, just kind of like what's sort of immediately in front of me. Okay. Left, right, about 45 degrees. Probably more like 90 degrees in reality, now that I think about it. Okay, so a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right of that target, what that threat was. And then and that only takes a second, right? And yes, I'm turning my head. I'm turning, looking left, turning, looking right. And then expanding, you know, beyond that. Then I'm going to go, you know, very deliberately to the left, all the way to my left, all the way trying to look all the way behind me, and then all the way back around and to the right. So that we're starting to cover that 360 degree circle of area. Because yes, the idea is that you just eliminated one threat and there absolutely could be another threat. So do occasionally, you're practicing at the range, and even if you're limited and you're stuck in some, you know, individual shooting lane, shoot your target and occasionally stop, look to the sides, and begin scanning all the way around, because it is a good thing, a good habit to get into. A related, by the way, and not on the list, but a related MMM is getting just in the habit of all you're doing is moving your head and looking around, but you're not really aware of what you're looking at. So the exercise I was beginning to describe is where you have a buddy or somebody behind you, and either they hold up a piece of paper with something written on it, you know, like, I don't know, peanut butter, you know, or maybe they hold up fingers, or maybe you tell them to describe, you know, what they see, what color shirt you're wearing, what color shoes or something, you know, like, so you have the person actually scan and look for something and try to identify, so that we keep the brain working when we're doing those types of exercises, I think is really good.
Yep. Cognition, right? Yep. We're trying to force it.
Yeah, totally. So number six, this one is, I see it as being related to this scanning MMM, because it tends to be a result of us, you know, sometimes working in range environments where we're not able to do as much as we probably would like to do, and that is remaining stationary. So, Jacob, why don't you enlighten us as to what the muscle memory mistake might be, with remaining stationary?
Yep. So obviously, in a self-defense situation, remaining stationary is really bad tactics. A couple reasons for this. One is that when you're exposed, you're more vulnerable. So getting to cover and or even at very least concealment goes a long way to your potential survival and positive outcome of the gunfight. But even something that you might not have thought about, we just got done talking about tunnel vision, right? Well, guess who else has tunnel vision? Your threat. Your threat also has a very narrow field of focus. And so just by you taking two steps in either direction, it's almost like you going invisible. They can't see you anymore because they also have tunnel vision. So moving is really critical tactics to a positive outcome in any sort of gunfight. And unfortunately, the MMM here is that we don't move. By nature of the way most of us train and practice and run repetitions and drills at the range or wherever it is we do our training, we hold still. And it's really, really, really bad MMM.
Yeah. Now, I mean, how do we train to not do this? I mean, it becomes very challenging when maybe the only range that is an option for you is one where you cannot shoot and move and so forth. Well, I would suggest this. I would suggest maybe look into competitive shooting, particularly like something like three gun, even USPSA, different shooting matches and things that might actually give you the opportunity where you're able to go to a range. I mean, like, my local indoor range that I go to almost on a weekly basis, they don't allow shooting and moving just, you know, anytime, you know, 8 to 5 or whatever, you know, during their normal business operations. You don't just walk in and able to go shoot and move, right? But they do have shooting matches where they'll close down part of their range, you know, one of their big shooting bays. And they do matches, shooting matches, and you're able to shoot and you're able to do other things, you know, move around and stuff. So maybe this would be an opportunity, if you haven't done so already, look into maybe some competition shooting, and that might give that opportunity where you're able to, you know, practice some of the shooting while moving. And then, of course, we can always do the dry fire practice. We can use CERT, mm-hmm. We can use LASR, we can do this in our home, we can practice these things. And where I think remaining stationary becomes also potentially deadly is where, and not just while we're shooting, but anytime that we got to do something with a gun, and this actually, Jacob, I don't mean to pick on you, buddy, but we were doing a little drill in your home, and we were doing a figure eight drill. We were going around these two objects in a figure eight and just trying to maintain sight picture and, you know, keep shooting this target. We were doing it with our CERT pistols, right? And then we told you, you know, okay, do a reload. And what happened when you attempted to do that reload?
Oh, it was a disaster. It was almost like I went to being like 8 years old. I just fell apart.
Well, and the big thing was you actually stopped moving, you know, while you were doing that reload, right?
Yeah, I couldn't cognitively like perform the reload while I was still moving. Like the brain wouldn't let me do it. It was like a freeze.
Yeah. And this is actually, I mean, I see very, very experienced shooters make the same mistake. And just by the way, by me just mentioning it to you, like, hey, Jacob, by the way, did you notice that you stopped moving when you were performing that reload? And you're like, oh, crap. And then after that, it wasn't an issue for you because you were aware of it. And so that's what I'm talking about here, you know, how easy it is to develop these muscle memory mistakes. And then sometimes it really doesn't take a whole lot to kind of shake you out of that.
Yeah, I you nailed it. That's so critical. I one other thing I learned from Brandon Scott, one of our network instructors in Utah, is he teaches his students that even if you're not allowed to move, if you're in a place where you're required to remain stationary when you're practicing, just by picking up your feet off the ground, you know, bending the knees and moving the legs a little, like they're not going to throw you out of the range if you don't actually change locations. But just, you know, picking up the feet and doing a little, you know, tap and dance a little bit, so to speak, that helps at least create some sort of, you know, better muscle memory than holding still, because you're telling the body that you do need to pick up the feet. So that was an interesting tip that I thought I liked.
Yep. I do remember him mentioning that in one of our episodes of the podcast way back when.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, like 18 or 10. I don't remember. It was quite a while ago. So yeah, good stuff there. All right. So on to MMM number 7, reholstering problems. And I think where we were going with this was is the tendency at times, you know, that a person will perform a drill or they'll shoot at their target and then immediately just go right back to the holster. And how dangerous that can be, because I mean that can very much be ingrained into you, so that, you know, you've got a threat and you do a really good job coming out of that holster automatically, and bam, 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 and you shoot that, you know, and maybe you're one of those people that comes out of the holster, double tap, and right back to the holster. Oh man, you are so asking for trouble if you do just that in a live, you know, deadly force encounter where you come right out of the holster, double tap, and you go right back. The thing that we have preached on before, and the thing we've preached on before is, why would you ever need to be in a hurry to get back to a holster? There's very few cases where you need to get back to a holster quickly. I can think of one exception, and that's if you're a law enforcement officer and you just had your gun out, and all of a sudden, and you got a cover officer there, okay. And all of a sudden you got to jump on a guy and throw cuffs on him. Like that's like one, you know, possible situation where you would want to get back to a holster quickly because you got a second to jump on this guy and get cuffs on him. Mm-hmm. That's
or transition to a different weapon.
Okay. I mean, yeah, right. Yeah. You just shot.
Same concept.
But once again, you know, there all other situations, pretty much, you don't have a need or reason to get back to a holster quickly. Right? And how often do we hear this, Jacob? You know, like we sell a lot of the Brave Response holster. And people are like, well, it's soft-sided. It, you know, it collapses. You know, that looks really difficult to reholster. It's like, why are you so concerned with getting back to the holster? Like, who cares if it takes you 5 minutes to get the gun reholstered? You know, well, what if the cops are showing up? Well, no, don't worry about that so much. What's a greater concern to me is the people that will come out quickly, on target, fire, right back to the holster, you know, super fast. Besides the fact that one of the most dangerous times you'll handle your gun is while reholstering. And doing it really quickly, I mean, why? Why? There's no need.
Yeah, and you know that. I can't remember what episode it was, but we actually had an episode where we talked quite a bit about, you know, how big of a problem is it really if the cops show up and your gun is still out? And the short of it is, it's probably not a big problem as long as you don't point it at them. But the main takeaway here is, to Riley's point, there's no need whatsoever for you to move quickly back to the holster. And because in a training environment, you know, where you're practicing, you're running repetitions and doing drills, you have no need to keep the gun out. You're done with the drill. You want to reset. It's almost like, as soon as I get this gun back in the holster, I can reset and run the drill again. And so you might be inclined to do it very quickly. Bam, 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 reholster. Okay. Go again. Well, then think about that MMM. You've created a very bad muscle memory mistake, because in a self-defense situation, you come out, boom, 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 and then poof, you're going to go right back to holster.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you just got done with neutralizing a threat, and that threat could actually still, even if you think that they might not be a threat anymore, they could still be. I mean, they're on the ground, they're playing dead. Or whatever, or they got a buddy that's, you know, lurking in the shadow somewhere and you don't initially see him, you know, you went back to the holster and all of a sudden their buddy pops out of the shadows, you know, like, you see what I mean? It's like we just got done neutralizing a threat. Keep that gun out, keep it trained on that threat. I mean, they were just trying to kill you. Keep that gun on the threat. You know, you're done shooting, but you can keep that gun trained on the threat until when? Well, until you are absolutely certain that the situation is done and over with. And usually I'm going to keep waiting there until a cop shows up. I'll be honest. Do you think a cop that just got involved in a shooting, you know, regardless if the suspect's totally dead on the ground, do you think he puts his gun away? No, he stands there, you know, he gets to a safe position, you know, he uses cover or whatever, and he's going to sit there with his gun out waiting for help to arrive. And only when somebody else, you know, cover, backup, shows up, are they going to, you know, maybe put their gun away or something. I mean, that's kind of the standard operating procedure. And I think that should be true, too, even with civilian shooters as well. So anyway, we've kind of beat on that one pretty good, I think. So the final number eight, and like I said, we could probably talk about other things that people are making mistakes with that translate into badly learned muscle memory. And but this is just our initial list of eight, and we're getting close to an hour here. So, you know, we like to try to keep it around an hour. This final one, though, I think is really interesting, especially because we have a couple of great stories to share about it. And we labeled this as picking up brass / putting in pockets. So, Jacob, why don't you share the story of picking up brass?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So imagine that law enforcement agencies are often very tight on budget, and brass is the kind of thing that an agency might be inclined to make sure they keep. You know, they can melt it down, they can sell it at weight, or they can sell it to reloading or even manufacturers if they have enough volume. So if you're a law enforcement agency and you might be running your officer through drills, and you know, you make sure you always tell them, hey, officer, we want you guys picking up the brass, and you're going to deposit in this bucket on your way out, kind of thing. So you might really drive that. And so this is something that a lot of agencies were doing for decades, is they were teaching their officers to pick up their brass because it was just an expense issue as a department. Well, the challenge that comes with that is that, imagine, you know, as time goes by, there start being some incidents, and this is documented. This is not Jacob, you know, making up crazy crap, but there's documented incidents of fire coming up on a scene where an officer has been shot, and even a dead officer, and they have brass in the hand. And so they were in the gunfight and picking up their brass, because the muscle memory was fire, 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 pick up my brass, fire some more. And so, you know, that MMM was so strong to go and pick up that brass as soon as they'd done firing the weapon.
Yeah, another famous, I think you're talking about, you know, one incident. Here's another incident that is very famous, very well documented. And it was of an officer way back in the 60s or 70s, you know, he's carrying and using a revolver, 357 Magnum revolver, you know, as his sidearm. And, you know, the standard practice was, you know, to keep from having to actually bend over and pick the brass up, his standard, you know, practice was he would fire his revolver, you know, open it up, dump the empty shell casings in his hand, stick them in his pocket, grab his, you know, reload the gun, and go back to firing. And so, you know, this officer actually ended up getting shot and killed, and investigators found that he had all this empty brass in his pockets, which indicated to them, I mean, this routine that he'd followed for years and years and years, which was the same routine. I mean, it's not just this one guy, right? Like, this was very true amongst a lot of revolver shooters, and still is. I mean, like, I promise you, a revolver shooter listening to us right now, this is what they do. You know, they open up the cylinder, they dump the empty brass in their hand, and because they don't have to throw it on the ground and then later go back and pick it up, it's very easy. It's right there in the hand. I can stick it in my pocket, or I can set it aside. Just understand that, you know, I started out this episode talking about we should train like we fight. In a real fight, are you going to take the time to catch that brass in your hand as you're trying to perform a reload on your revolver? No. You're just going to dump and be done with that. Get that brass on the ground. You don't care about it, okay? You need to get back into the fight as quickly as possible. And so that's a great example of where, you know, training with these various habits ends up translating into the real world, and sometimes with deadly consequences. So be very mindful of that. And I've got one other example I wanted to share that is one I meant to share actually at some point in this episode, and I just think it's a really great example. I'm a big believer in you know, I teach people, if you're racking your slide on your semi-automatic, I want to see you use, you know, your whole hand, reach over the top of the back of the slide with your whole hand, pull it back, you know, retract the slide that way. This is true, especially so I think, even when you're, you know, you got a slide back. Okay, so you just fired your gun dry, the slide is locked back, and you're going to perform a combat reload. I expect that that next magazine goes in the gun, and that you reach over, and the same way you grasp the slide with the whole hand, you pull it back slightly, you release, right? Rather than, because the alternative is, and this is one I see all the time, using the slide lock, that little button with your thumb, and hitting that to get the slide to close forward, you know, chambering around. And the reason for that is because there's a video of a law enforcement officer who, in a shooting, shot his gun dry, reloaded. You know, he had his slide locked back. He reloads, and then he fumbles for a second or two while he's trying to get that slide lock released with his thumb, right? And that cost him precious seconds. As opposed to, you know, how much simpler is it just to grab the slide, pull back slightly, release? You know, like, that's how the gun is designed. It's going to work. You know, because and the example I use along with that all the time is that that's more of a gross motor skill where you're grasping the slide with the whole hand, pulling back and releasing it, as opposed to this fine motor skill of using your thumb and hitting this little tiny button that, you know, releases the slide and going forward. So that's why I preach that all the time, is because of this very thing right here. Because if you use that little slide lock to release your slide each time you're loading your gun, that becomes the muscle memory, and you will potentially fumble that when you're trying to do this under stress in real life.
Yeah, great example.
So that actually almost becomes like a number 9 to our list of MMMs. You know, don't use that little button for releasing your slide. But anyway, Yep. But you know, it goes back to, you know, we mentioned these stories. Some of the things we talk about, I'm sure people are like, oh, that's not that big a deal, or that's not going to be an issue. But the reality is, whatever you do repeatedly over and over and over again becomes habit. It becomes muscle memory. And that's why we decided to talk about this topic today, muscle memory mistakes, or MMM, 8 inadvertent training blunders, and we hope that you won't do them. And we also hope that if you notice anything else you're doing that doesn't translate well into a real fight, that you'll stop doing it, because we should be training like we fight. Jacob, any last thoughts on the topic?
No, I think that's good. And I'd love to hear, if anyone is listening to this, if you have ideas that have come to mind of other MMMs that you have seen, have observed, or have caught yourself doing, you know, send those to us.
Oh, absolutely. That's always good stuff to have, and it's also very good. And we love getting feedback from you, our listeners, our loyal listeners. We really do appreciate for supporting us in this podcast. Speaking of the podcast, today's episode is brought to you by Guardian Nation Live, which is our monthly live broadcast with industry experts. Every third Thursday evening, we broadcast live via video to all of our Guardian Nation members. You do have to be a member of Guardian Nation to attend and or have access to the recording. Last month, we had Mike Hughes, Top Shot Season 3 runner-up, on the broadcast. And it was I think by all accounts, everyone that participated in that broadcast in that edition of Guardian Nation Live, it was a hit. Tomorrow evening will be our second ever Guardian Nation Live event. And we're going to be live with Alex Rogolski, military and law enforcement veteran, and also a world-ranking competitive shooter and tactical firearms instructor. He is the real deal. He's a sponsored shooter by the Glock store. At one time, he was ranked number 24 in the world for trap shooting. The point is, Alex knows his stuff. And we're so excited to have him on Guardian Nation Live with us tomorrow evening. And in fact, longtime listeners of the podcast, or if you started way in the beginning, episode 3 of the Concealed Carry podcast, we did together with Alex Rogolski. So we're going to be having him on the webinar tomorrow night. And just so you know, that's at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. You got to be a Guardian Nation member before that, before 7 p.m. tomorrow night, to get access to the Guardian Nation Live webinar. Guardian Nation members also can find the recordings of past webinars, as well as all the other great training videos and content in our members-only part of Guardian Nation. We encourage everyone to join us with the webinar tomorrow, and also that you would join Guardian Nation so that you can be on live with us tomorrow evening. We're going to be talking about dealing with law enforcement, how to interact with law enforcement, you know, including in deadly encounters, deadly force encounters. You know, you just had to shoot somebody in your home or on the street. You know, what do you do? How do you handle that? We're going to be talking also, too, a little bit about, and this was Alex's idea. His idea, because he had come across a situation where civilians had done a building search because they thought they had an intruder, and some of the potential dangers with that. So, you know, here tomorrow evening from a longtime, you know, law enforcement veteran, you know, on his thoughts on law enforcement, you know, things to do or not do as civilians as it relates to dealing with law enforcement, and a whole host of other things. And don't forget, you will always get the opportunity for Q&A with our special monthly webinar guests. Jacob, anything you want to add to that?
Yep. I know that listeners of this podcast, you guys probably got tired of us sometimes pounding on some of these things, you know, week after week after week, us saying you need to join this thing or buy this thing. But you know, hopefully you understand that two really important things. One, we wouldn't pound on it if we didn't really believe in it. And two, we think that this is what it takes. And we think that these are the things you need in order to be a guardian, to be able to stand up and defend yourself and others from the criminals and threats around
us. Yep. That's completely right. So on to picks of the week. Jacob, what's your pick this week?
So my pick this week is the SOG Reactor. So SOG, I think people are familiar with SOG as a brand. They make knives, lots of SOG products out there. The Reactor is interesting. It is a knife multi-tool. Now, I think, you know, everyone's familiar with like a Gerber or a Leatherman, you know, kind of thing, which is a multi-tool which happens to have a knife in it, right? This is a knife that happens to have pliers in it.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite idea. It's like they made a knife first, and then they're like, let's add some other things to it. And I really appreciate that. It's not the kind of thing that's meant to go into like a belt pouch. It has a pocket clip, so I still clip it into my pocket the same way I would any other pocket knife. And it still has a very, you know, awesome knife. It's assisted open. It's a really good pocket knife. But I can, in fact, fold it out and use the pliers. It also has a screwdriver, you know, flathead and Phillips on it, a little bottle opener. So I appreciate that it's a pocket knife first and then a multi-tool and not the other way around. Hmm.
Well, I like how you explain that. And I'm familiar with the SOG Reactor, but I guess I hadn't really, you know, thought of in that way, that knife first, then a multi-tool. Because, you know, I think I even featured it as my pick of the week. I've got it right on me right now because it's always with me. You know, my Leatherman Wave, which, based on your description, this is a multi-tool first, a knife second. So now I'm feeling a little bit less awesome, Jacob.
You should be. You need the Reactor. It's so sweet.
Although I do still swear and stand by Leatherman products. I think they're great. But I'm going to look into that SOG Reactor.
Yeah, I mean, think about it this way. Like, when you open, if you want to get your knife out, what do you have to do? You have to pull it out. You have to essentially open the pliers, and then you unfold the knife and then close the pliers, yeah. Right?
Although that is not how it works on the Wave, by the way, because the Wave...
Oh, so maybe the Wave is special.
But it still isn't... Like, you said that the SOG Reactor has assisted opening. I did not know. So I'm like, ooh, that's kind of cool.
With the SOG, I literally pull it out and hit the assisted open with my thumb, and boom, I have a knife.
Cool. Very cool. My pick this week, by the way, is three-gun shooting. You know, for years and years I've been shooting. I love shooting. I've done some, like, informal, you know, like, competing with friends and family. And believe me, I have some family and friends that are great shooters. So some of the competitions within ourselves are you know, legit, you know, shooting competitions. But it wasn't until really this year that I started getting involved in competitive shooting. Many of our listeners are familiar that I'm going to be at Nationals in January for American Marksman. You know, and this year I just started getting involved. And so I just actually shot last weekend my first ever like official three-gun match. I can't believe it took me as long as it did to actually get around to doing that, because I am completely and utterly hooked now. And it was a wonderful experience. We could definitely probably talk about how some competitive shooting could actually develop MMMs, you know, muscle memory mistakes, because just the way some things are handled and done. But I'll tell you one thing that competitive shooting helps you to do, besides I used the example earlier about, you know, having the opportunity to shoot and move and things like that, which definitely has value. The other thing is that it really shows to you the deficiencies that you have, because you're under time, you're under pressure, you're under stress. And I'll tell you, I fumbled one of my reloads with my pistol. And, you know, like, I practice that all the time. And I went, you know, clearly I have to practice more. And that became motivation for me to come home and work at my reloads even more, even more, even more, you know, with more intensity than I've ever had before. So, you know, check it out, you know. And we're kind of at the end of the season now, but three-gun shooting or any sort of competition shooting, I think, you know, check, you know, look into it. But three-gun is just, oh, shotgun, rifle, pistol. I mean, what more could you want?
Yeah.
Up next, Jacob.
Yeah, so up next, the last couple of weeks, I've talked about how we're working on the welcome kit for Guardian Nation members, and we've kind of finalized everything. So everything's ordered. We're waiting for T-shirts to be printed, and something that we're actually including in the welcome kits, I don't think we've advertised anywhere or put anywhere on a webpage, is a handgun cleaning mat. It's a custom design cleaning mat that will be going out as part of the welcome kit. And so anyway, all that's been ordered. It's being printed and produced and manufactured and whatever. And so hopefully we'll actually get those things shipped out here in about a week.
Yeah. Awesome. And for my up next, I'm going to kind of cop out on this one a little bit. You know, we got that webinar coming up. So looking forward to that. It's going to be fun. You'll see Jacob and myself and Alex Rogolski tomorrow evening. If, you know, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, it'd be tomorrow because it's Thursday. Thursday, what is that? November 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain. That's 9 p.m. on the East Coast, 6 p.m. on the West Coast. So that's what I got coming up next.
And anytime you're listening to this, I'll just add the Guardian Nation live broadcasts or webinars are recorded. So if you miss these, if you're listening to this, you know, long after that's taken place, just know that, you know, Guardian Nation members do have access to all the recordings as well.
Absolutely. Which is, you know, I mean, we really meant for that to be the case, because we recognize that not every member either is going to be able to make the third Thursday evening of every month, you know, so they'll always have the opportunity to go back and rewatch those, or watch those for the first time, or rewatch them if you participated and you can't remember something that was said. Well, you have the opportunity to go back in the Guardian Nation members only area and rewatch those webinar broadcasts. So, as always, if you haven't done so already, we really hope you'll take the opportunity now to go subscribe to the podcast. You know, we definitely don't want you to miss out on anything. We've got some exciting things coming up. I mean, besides webinars, and we're announcing tomorrow's webinar today. You know, who's on and stuff. But also, we got like Black Friday coming up, which we're making a big deal of. So, you know, there'll be probably some special announcements relating to that. Plus just the hopefully overall, you know, great content that we strive to provide you on the podcast. We just really sincerely hope you don't miss out on any of it. So please subscribe now. And if you haven't already, follow us and like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. We are continually working towards doing more and more video content and fleshing out that YouTube presence of ours, as well as other sources. So anyway, check us out there. And we really do sincerely, as I mentioned already before, really appreciate each and every single one of you for listening and tuning into the podcast each and every Monday and Wednesday. So thanks so much. We're going to bid you all farewell at this time. Jacob?
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Good point. That is coming up. I mean, we will have another episode or two before that, but indeed, happy Thanksgiving. It's a special time of the year, one of my favorite holidays of the year. My last words would be just, you know, train hard, you know, follow through on the things that we talk about. Train hard, train hard, train hard. That's all I could say. Take care, folks. Be safe out there. We'll see you later.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.